Well, welcome to the latest episode here of the Dan Time Podcast. If you like discovering new music and you like baseball like I do, hopefully you found a show that it feels like it's tailor-made just for you. With that being said, today's guest, this is really exciting, episode number 101, and I'm pleased to welcome who I consider, in my research, the authority on Montreal Expos baseball. If there is a peer in this realm, I'd like to know that person's name, and I'm sure Danny would be interested to know who that person is as well, because this is probably the most thorough research you're going to find, I would argue, on most Major League Baseball teams, past or present. Danny Gallagher, my guest today, has published 11 books on the Expos. The latest, and I'm pleased to have a copy with me here if you can see it. This is called Explosion, Genesis to Relocation, 1994 Saga, Contraction, Revelations About the Dying Days, Lenny Schneids, and the Expos. This is the latest in a long series about the Expos, and no surprise, May 2026, or early spring, we'll call it, another book on the Expos, Willie Davis, The Tragedy of Willie Davis, and more Expos stories. And Danny has published hundreds of articles on the team. And I want to come out and say, because some of you may be hearing, okay, well, that's some good material on the Expos. Fans of baseball, and I would even say fans of sports, you're going to love these books. There are stories just in the 2024 book, Explosion, on Terry Francona, on Moises Alou, Gene Mauch. There is material in here that you have never heard before on any outlet. And it's a fascinating read. And it's a great book, as I believe some of the other ones are in the catalog, where you can sit down, flip it open, get to a random chapter, and start reading and enjoying it. But Danny, I'm really rambling here. I'm great at doing that. Welcome to the show. Thanks for making time to be on Dan Time.
Yeah, Dan, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Always nice to talk about the Expos and baseball in general. It's been a passion of mine since 1988 as far as publishing, you know, books, because that's the year I joined the staff of the Montreal Daily News covering the Expos. So ever since then, I've been, as you say, I've been writing hundreds of articles about the Expos and coming out with my 11th book in 2026 with special emphasis on Willie Davis.
There's a real fascination about the Montreal Expos. If you look around, and people are familiar with teams that have been relocated over the years, markets that have lost teams. You've got, of course, the Brooklyn Dodgers. Brooklyn Dodgers, New York Giants, those franchises move west at the end of the 50s. But as we know, New York gains the Mets. Milwaukee loses the Braves to Atlanta. As we know, Milwaukee gains the Brewers later on. Baltimore loses the Orioles to Washington, but then they get the Orioles back. Seattle, the doomed pilot season, but give it a few years, they've got the Mariners. Washington loses the Senators, gets the Senators back, or the Nationals, by way of Montreal. Kansas City, the Athletics, move to Oakland. Kansas City, of course, has the Royals now. You really have to go to, and we all know what's happened with Oakland and this limbo period in Sacramento for the A's. But you really have to go back to, in some cases, the 19th century. Indianapolis, Buffalo, Louisville. Danny, is there another municipality in modern history that has lost a franchise and we just don't know if we're ever going to have another major league ball club in that city again?
Well, it's possible, you know, all this time, 21 years that the Expos left for Washington, you know, from 2004 to 2012, there really was no talk about anybody interested in promoting a new team in Montreal. And then in 2012, Juan Cromartie, the former Expo, started beating the drums. And he was meeting with some Major League Baseball officials, but really didn't have any money. Juan Cromartie has no money then, and he had no money now. But he, for many years, he was, you know, a silent beat drummer, wanting the Expos back. And then a few years ago, Stephen Bronfman, the son of the former Expos owner, Charles Bronfman, showed a lot of interest in getting the team back in Montreal. But he was especially interested in the split-season sister city concept with Tampa Bay, which really didn't work out because Stephen Bronfman did not have a lot of money compared to his father. So he has said that he did not have the financial resources to have a what you call a full-time team, meaning 162 games. But he was interested in the Tampa concept where 41 games would be played in Montreal. And Tampa Bay supposedly would pay a lot of the expenses. And Bronfman's group would get some of the money for the Tampa Bay home games played in Montreal. And then, of course, as you know, that was turned down by Major League Baseball in January of 2022. So since then, it's been kind of bleak and nobody has really showed any interest.
When I heard about that concept, I thought that there's just call it some psychological problems with that. If you live in Montreal or you live in Tampa Bay, and it's like, okay, half this team is mine, half of it belongs to this other city. It's psychologically, I just don't feel like it works for the fan. You don't feel like you're the same. It's your same ball club as a Texas Rangers fan or Pittsburgh Pirates fan. They don't have to share it with anybody. But that was my thought, my first reaction to that.
For sure. I don't know what the fan reaction would have been. Let's say if that was pulled off, how the Montreal fans would react to it, to a team that was not called the Montreal Expos, called Tampa Bay X-Rays or whatever you want to call them. But it was Stephen Bronfman's idea of getting baseball at least back into Montreal in some form or concept, and that later on possibly a full-time team would come. But that was ideal for him because he just didn't have the money for a team playing 162 games. And, you know, the Players Association didn't like that idea of the Rays playing games in Montreal. The Tampa Bay players would have had to get accommodation in Montreal while they already have an apartment or a house in Tampa Bay.
Sure. I do want to say, Danny, with these publications coming out, I think yearly for, you know, up until 2024, I think you've released five books or a book every year for at least 5 or 6 years. This in tandem with the interest in the Montreal Expos memorabilia, the jerseys, the t-shirts, the hats, people are still buying these items. And everybody loves nostalgia. And you never know with the next generation, you know, what they're driven by. But I feel like, and you probably agree, we're kind of sitting back in this lull period. We don't really see any action on the horizon, but it hasn't, I don't feel like it will ever completely vanish, this interest in the Montreal Expos, in their certainly in their past, but kind of the what if. Can we make this work again? What's it going to take? Do we need to, the city need to finance a new baseball stadium and just say, we'll build a stadium? Has that ever been discussed, or do you think there's any conversations being had about really rolling the dice there and trying to finance a stadium and then seeing how the league will respond?
Yeah, you know what? The estimate of getting an expansion franchise is about $2.3 billion U.S. or $3 billion Canadian, which is pretty high. And then to get a new stadium downtown Montreal would be, let's say, another billion Canadian. And as you know, Dan, the city of Montreal and the province of Quebec spent close to $1 billion recently, and I guess they're still renovating the roof and the perimeter of the roof at Olympic Stadium in the East End. So that was kind of like a signal saying that, okay, we're fixing up Olympic Stadium, but not for baseball. When what they did was they redid the configuration of the Olympic Stadium field, but not for baseball. They made it more for football and soccer. But they told me that, let's say, baseball, let's say the Blue Jays came back and they want to play another exhibition series 1 year, that they could change the field into baseball again. But it would require somebody with deep pockets then to get another franchise. It's Rob Manfred, the commissioner, said that he would like to expand in the final year of his year as a commissioner in 2029. So you're talking another 4 years. You never know if somebody might come out of the blue and try to get something going. Warren Cromartie, you know, told me recently, and he told a talk show host in Montreal recently, that he's trying to get Japanese investors in Japan, where he lives about 6 months of the year as a broadcaster. But nobody has come forth in the 2.5 years since the Tampa Bay situation was turned down.
Danny, I want to take you back to that year, 1988, when you became the beat reporter for the Montreal Expos while working with the Montreal Daily News.
That's right.
And coincidentally, at my age, that was around the time that I started watching baseball in earnest. I started collecting baseball cards in 88. By 89, I was watching most games on TV that I could watch after school when I could watch them. I was a big fan, 1988, 1989. I'll start with that. Now, you told a story on the Good Seats Still Available podcast episode. And at the end of this episode, I do want to kind of rattle off some appearances that you've made, and I'll list them in the show notes. But you told a great story about one of your favorite Expo players, Rusty Staub. When he comes back to Montreal around the time that I was born, late July of 79, and you described this setting that I don't recall seeing in 1989, 1990, 91 on TV. You described something like 50,000 Expos fans cheering as loud as they can. He's coming up to bat as a pinch hitter in the second game of a doubleheader. And I'm curious if you can describe for our listeners who, like me, you know, we're not 25, but we're 45, and we just don't remember just a rocking crowd at Olympic Stadium. What was it like back then?
It was electric. You see, he had been with Detroit and several other teams after he left the Expos in 1971 and went to the Mets. He had 3 years with the Expos, 69, 70, 71. And so he was like an early franchise hero. You know, people loved him. And when they brought him back in that trade with Detroit in July of 1979, they had played several games on the road, and then they finally came back to Montreal for his first game back in Montreal. So at that time, I was working for the Ottawa Journal newspaper, but not as a – I did not go to the game as a reporter. I went there with my girlfriend because I'd grown up in the Ottawa area and went to a number of Expos games as a fan before I became a beat writer, in 88. So that game, it was electrifying. So he comes up with a pinch hitter, and he can't get into the batter's box because the fan noise is so much. He had to step out several times. It was electric. It wasn't so much the bat itself. It was the moment in which he tried to get into the box, and the fan applause was so deafening that he had to step out several times. It was just an applause of a hero coming back to Montreal. Maybe, I don't know whether you call him the prodigal son, but it was quite a tremendous gathering. You know, he went out, he popped up to the outfield, but the moment of him being in the batter's box was electrifying.
Wow. And coming back to 1988, this must be an exciting year for you. Otis Nixon signs with the Expos, granted free agency by the Indians, I believe. He comes over. Randy Johnson, the big unit, a late September call-up. Do you have any special memories in 88? Maybe like when you... Did you see Randy Johnson in spring training? Do you remember seeing him around the clubhouse there at the very end of the season?
I was covering for the Montreal Daily News when he made his first appearance for the Expos in Montreal. And so, you know, you walk in the clubhouse, you're 6'10". You're looking up at him. He said, I'm looking forward to this game. And he won, from what I remember, he won his first game. And then he was kind of up and down to, you know, Indianapolis for 88 and 89. And then, you know, Dan, as you know, he got traded to Seattle for, along with Brian Holman and Gene Harris, for Michael Engston. And they wanted to go for it. They wanted an experienced pitcher like Michael Engston. And at the time, they were leading the National League East by, you know, a fair number of games. And Langston, they wanted somebody else to come in and continue the push for win the National League East. And, you know, Langston was reasonably good. And then, but the bats fell apart in August and September, and just a real fiasco. They finished up at 81 and 81. And, you know, it was a case of the Expos felt that Randy Johnson maybe wasn't quite ready to come in and be a pitcher on a full-time basis, because at the time of the trade, he was in the minor leagues. But it's like pushing the cart before the horse. Could you have waited until Randy got better? But that particular year, they were getting close to a championship, NL championship, and the owner, Charles Boffman, gave Dave Dombrowski, the manager, to go ahead and make this trade. But then, you know, everybody today is criticizing that trade, but there's also some people who like the trade because the Expos pushed to get a better pitcher into the rotation.
Danny, there's just so much to cover here. A lot of things on my mind I want to talk about, and then talk about some things in the book. You may have mentioned this or certainly written about it in some prior books, but wow, if Major League Baseball had just one wild card, two, certainly three wild cards like we have now in the early 80s, in the mid 80s, maybe, you know, at the end of the 70s, it is preposterous. 1987 Expos, 20 games over 500, 91 and 71. They finished third in the division. Do not reach the playoffs. Of course, everybody knows about the 94 team. The 93 team, 94 and 68, that's good for second place. Missed the playoffs. There's another year here. I think they're 30 games over 500. 1979, 95 and 65. And in 79, that's good enough for second place. A lot of young baseball fans are maybe hearing that and thinking, how are you just knocking them dead and finishing with a few games shy of 100 wins and you're not playing in October?
It's really crazy. As you say, 79 and 80 and 82, they had a good team and then they kind of faded. But 79, 80, 1993, 1987, you know, it was just some great, great baseball. They should have been really unfortunate that they didn't get into the playoffs. Now, the Expos had a mini dynasty from 79 to 82. They finally get in the playoffs in 81, but they probably had even better teams in 79, 80. And some people said the team in 82 was really, really good too. But, and even 83, they faded too. But I agree with you. If they had the wild card, it would have been so much better. The popularity of baseball in those years in Montreal and general in baseball.
Because and Montreal is a unique city in the sense that there's always events and festivals and things to do with your money and places to take the kids and places to go on a date besides going to a baseball game. It's not totally unlike a lot of other cities, but do you think Montreal always struggled with that, where if they just had had one playoff berth via a wild card, or if they had, you know, 1981 goes differently and they reach the postseason, they win the pennant. It's like they needed one postseason run to compete with all the other events in town and just going into the next year, being a strong draw all the time.
Exactly. You know, 93, that team was almost good as 94. 93, you know, they changed a few people for 94, but that was a tremendous team. If they had been able to keep a lot of those players with maybe a bigger budget, then they maybe could have, maybe even 92 when Felipe took over, it turned out to be a pretty good team at the end. And then, you know, 94, as you know, with the strike, they weren't able to complete that year, and that would have been a wild card year. Let's say even if they had not won first place, they probably would have made the playoffs as a wild card. And then, you know, with playoff money, let's say 79, 80, 87, 93, and 94, you're able to build up a revenue chest of money to keep players to stay around for a few years. But what happened with the 94 team, when that strike carried into the next year and then it was finally settled, the Expos ownership wanted to trade Ken Hill, Marquise Grissman, John Wetland, and they didn't want to offer a contract to Larry Walker. So that was kind of like the beginning of the end of the Expos, but they stayed around for 10 more years.
Yeah, and those are fan favorites. Those are kids going to these ball games. They love Larry Walker. They love Marquise Grissom. And that had, especially when the Marlins, in 1997, they won the World Series, and then all those players are gone the next year. Danny, there's a, and folks, again, this book, Explosion, which I've been just having a blast reading, but without giving too much away, you've got a chapter in here where Claude Delorme, the Executive Vice President of Business Affairs, not somebody's name that people may be familiar with in the media or the reports of the end of the Expos, but this is literally the guy that turned off the lights for the last time in the offices at Olympic Stadium by himself. The way that you wrote in that chapter, Danny, gave me goosebumps. It's very, almost a visceral feeling, because he's kind of spending more time in Florida at that time, kind of getting into the spring of 05, but he's flying back up to Montreal to tie up some loose ends. And then, of course, that there's a final day where you're not coming back to that ballpark, and a very lonely, very melancholy description of how it all ended. I just can't imagine. And he spent 20 years with the ball club. I think you wrote in that chapter that he would have stayed forever. Very sad.
Yeah, see, that, what you're telling me, is just sending shivers up my spine right now, Dan. Just thinking of Claude Delorme, because he was an unsung hero who maybe most people didn't know about, but he worked his buns off to keep it alive as the vice president of business operations, the stadium operations. And at the end, on September 28th, which is the night of the 28th after the game, they finally, all of a sudden, there was a rumor that the team is finally moving to Washington. There had been no signal all through the 2004 season that the team was going to be moved. There was a schedule made up for the 2005 season with Montreal in it. So Claude Delorme was the guy. It wasn't the president of the team or the general manager who kind of was winding up the operations and doing interviews with the media. Tony Tavares and the president and Omar Minaya, they had something to do with the end of it too. But Claude became the spokesperson explaining to the media what's going on. And they had somebody from Major League Baseball who came to Montreal in secret conditions to speak to the players. He was not introduced to the crowd, but the crowd would have really booed him. I'm not trying to remember that guy's name, but your story is really a lot of intrigue about Claude Delorme coming a couple of times to Olympic Stadium for a few months after they left for Washington and conducting league matters, winding up the Expos operations. And then I think April, I like the way you put it, April 30th of 2005, and he turns out the lights for the last time. I've got shivers right now.
And then, other nameless people in the organization, secretaries, just various office personnel that had perhaps been with the Expos for 7 years or 10 or 12 or how, there had to have been people like that, that all of a sudden, like you said, the end came at the end of the season. It wasn't like they knew in July, hey, this is going to be a wrap in a few months. Those people weren't going to Washington. They live and work in Montreal. They work for the Expos. How many people do you think from the front office were just on edge of which direction this was going to take, and then they got to go find work somewhere else?
Yeah, the rumors and the scuttlebutt had been going on for 2 or 3 years, ever since Major League Baseball took over the Expos by buying the team from Jeffrey Loria, who bought the Florida Marlins, and John Henry came in and bought the Red Sox. So I suppose it was not a total surprise that the Expos were moving to Washington, but it was still a shock. On the day of the 29th, the final home game, a lot of the players who I talked to in that book and other books, they weren't in street clothes. They may have been in their uniforms too, but they walked into the Expos office to say goodbye to the Expos employees. It was very tearful for some of those players and the employees. It was really heartbreaking. And, after the final game, Brad Wilkerson broke down in tears because he was thinking of those employees who were no longer going to have a job. So he had to be held up and composed by Claude Raymond, the former Expo, who had done some speeches. And he had to hold his arm around Brad Wilkerson and tell him, hang in there. But Brad Wilkerson, he was the epitome of the grief and the depression that took place on the final game in September 29, 2004.
Somebody had to be the guy to carry it all on his shoulders.
Yeah, I talked to a few of those. In this book, I made an attempt. This is my big attempt, although I tried in other books, but this was a big attempt to explore how that came about, that the team was leaving on the 29th, and that there had been a relocation committee set up earlier in 2004 as to where they might send the Expos. It could have been Portland, Oregon, or Charlotte, North Carolina, or Nashville, or... So I talked to some of those people who were on the relocation committee, and I wrote a letter to Bud Selig at his house address to see if he might talk to me again. I'd talked to him before, and he was kind enough to talk to me, but this time he didn't want to talk. Maybe he just didn't want to talk enough about this topic. Anyway, there is several chapters in there, Dan, about the relocation of the team. So I kind of explored that topic in a big way in this book.
Another thing I wrote down here, and I think this is something you said on a podcast episode that I really appreciate, Danny, because I like to have guests on my show that sometimes it's a singer-songwriter that's trying to get their music out there, and they're not a household name, but man, they've got some great songs. Or I've had some ball players. I've had Major League Baseball players or former players. But you said that you do a lot of stories on players who are not stars. These are the utility men, the pinch hitters, the platoon players, trying to give some recognition on what they encountered. I always had a fascination with those guys that maybe were a big personality, not a big bat, you know, but you love seeing them on TV when their number was called in the ninth inning. You're just thinking, okay, let's one swing of the bat. Let's get some a couple runs in here. And you really do a great job of romanticizing those players in this book, Explosion, and I'm sure in some past books as well. And one that I particularly enjoyed was being Dan time was the Dan Norman chapter. Dan Norman, who I learned reading his story, and he's the current manager for the Chatham-Kent Barnstormers, which I had a guest on the show, Dan Kabelka, who founded or brought Challenger Baseball to Chatham over 30 years ago. Challenger Baseball being a program for children and adults with special needs. But I love the story about Dan Norman, wanted to be a stuntman, wanted to get involved in movies. And reading about his career, it sounded like everywhere he was, whether it's Cincinnati or the Mets, and he's involved in the Seaver trade, the Reardon trade. Everywhere he goes, it's a stacked outfield. Where is he going to fit in? And it reminded me, there's so many players, and I'm glad that you highlight these guys, that superstars sometimes become superstars because a lot of them had the natural ability, but a lot of them also got regular playing time. So if you're with an organization and you're not playing every day at the major league level, your narrative maybe goes a different way, but love that stuff, Danny. And what are some thoughts there on Dan Norman?
Oh, wow. So I've done a fair number of work in the movie business as an actor and sort of a part-time actor since 1995. So I found it intriguing when he started talking that he worked in several movies and he wanted to be a stuntman. But he was, his football team was picked to go and be part of some movie. I forget, I don't have the book in front of me, but so I don't think, he never did get to be, learn to be a stuntman, but because he had some other things he had to do, and then he became, you know, a minor league player, and he played a little bit, you know, with the Expos and Mets, and you know, he didn't, as you say, when he got to the Expos were stacked, and he told me, I'm not going to get much playing time here, you know.
You got Andre Dawson and Tim Raines and Warren Cromartie in the outfield. Where
exactly. So, and then he got himself a niche of coaching baseball for many, many years, and that's what he's been doing. And so Chatham Kent of the Ontario's Inter-County Baseball League in Canada picked him to be the manager last year in the first season, and he's back again this year. But he's like an unsung hero. You know, he never played much in the majors. I like to humanize these part-time players. I like the word you use, romanticize these players, because people don't necessarily hear about them much, or maybe they don't want the baseball card or autograph because they're part-time players. But I think they're a really important part of the team, because without them, it gives the team credibility to have these part-time players. You know, one of my favorite players, I'll do it quick, in the book is Rick DeHart from Topeka, Kansas, who found out about an Expos training camp in Florida. So he took a Greyhound bus from Kansas to Florida, and he ended up getting a contract out of the camp and got enough service time in the major leagues to get a pension plan. So that's an example of a guy I love to talk about.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask him, who is maybe your all-time favorite utility player?
I would think that Otis Nixon, you mentioned him at the start, when he came in 1988, he had some drug problems with the Atlanta Braves.
The Indians.
I forget who it was, but the Expos have had a history of reclamation projects, somebody who was into drugs or alcohol or a hearing impediment in the case of Curtis Pride. But Otis had some drug problems. Dennis Martinez had drug problems. Well, no, he was more of a drinking problem. Dennis didn't have a drug problem. But they decided to bring up Otis Nixon from the minors a couple months into the 88 season, and he was just gangbusters for the Expos on the base pass. And he was good until spring training in 1991. When he was traded to Atlanta. So they had him for 3 years, and he was shocked when he was traded. It was on April the 1st, and when he came out of the meeting, he said, I thought it was an April Fool's Day joke. And I was told that he cried his eyes out when he was traded to Atlanta because he loved Montreal so much. And he was traded to give Marquis Grissom more playing time because Grissom was coming into the forefront as a pretty good player, so they wanted to give Grissom more playing time in the outfield. But no, Otis always been great to talk to over the years, and he always remembers me.
I've got a copy of his book from many years ago, Keeping It Real.
Yes, you know, the same year they brought up Rex Sutler, who was failing in the Yankees organization, so the two of them brought up some speed that year and put the team for a few years.
Okay, that's it for part one of my conversation with Danny Gallagher. Be sure to subscribe to the Dan Time Podcast on any platform so you catch part two as soon as it's released. And head over to YouTube and follow me at Dan Time Pod. You can watch the entire conversation, the video episode, on YouTube now. You can follow Dan Time at Dan Time Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and X. Have a great week.